Last week, Kate gave the Dharma talk, and actually I was scheduled to, but we switched so that she could be available to do the memorial service. And as probably many of you, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the kind of distress that we see in the world today, the kind of pain and suffering due to COVID, and of course, all the other events that we're seeing in the newspaper. And I remembered a koan that I had reflected on quite a while ago. And so today I'm going to kind of make that the kind of focus of the talk. And I'm calling this, "What Do You Call the World?" And it will become clear in a few minutes, because that's one of the lines in the koan. So, as we're all aware of, these are deeply troubling times, full of uncertainty, unrest, sickness, of course, unexpected death. And in addition, our usual ways of living, of conducting our life, are rather curtailed. Our usual distractions maybe are no longer available. And we each, I think, struggle with the present circumstances in our own ways during this time of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the other day, in discussion with some friends, Kate described the present time as one of feeling suspended. And that really resonated with me, the sense of kind of feeling suspended in some ways. But in addition to that feeling of being kind of suspended, there's also perhaps a feeling of not being quite in control as we used to be. And that does seem to be pretty pervasive when I'm talking with other people. And of course, reading or watching the news, we become more and more aware of the racial injustice, the political kind of polarization that's going on, the crises with refugees around the world, particularly at this time with COVID, homelessness, increasing poverty. It seems for many that this is a time of calamity. Thinking about this, I kind of remembered, I guess, or I gave some thought that, you know, our Zen tradition that we practice arose in China during a time of great disaster and suffering. It was a great time of uncertainty in China, unrest, sickness, and of course, unexpected death. Many of the things that we're experiencing today. This school, Chan in Chinese language, or Zen in Japanese, the Chinese practitioners like us needed to find a way to meet the chaos that swirled around them and towards the middle and the end of the Tang Dynasty. And the Tang Dynasty kind of started about 618 and ended in the about 900 AD. So it lasted quite a while. And the first half of the Tang Dynasty was a time of great cultural flowering, openness to the world at large. In fact, the capital, Chang'an, was the greatest city in the world at that time, largest population and the most cosmopolitan, with many people from Europe and from the Middle East, travelers who had come to China, hearing of the great dynasty that was going on there. So they came to trade, and many of them ended up living there. It's considered by historians a golden age for Chinese arts and culture. Particularly poetry and painting reached great heights there. Woodblock printing increased. There was great literacy. And Buddhism flourished. This is during the Tang Dynasty. The first half is when Buddhism really spread throughout China. So it was a period of great prosperity, progress, stability, until about the middle of that period. The central authority began to weaken, and then there was a great rebellion known as the An Lushan Rebellion. And this was an armed conflict between the various kind of regional powers that had arisen, and especially the outside of the central China, and battling with the Tang authorities. And it started about 750 and ended around 763 or so, so a little over a decade. And the Tang dynasty was able to reestablish itself and take power then. But the death toll that was there at that time, not only due to the, of course, combat casualties, but the collateral, as they say, civilian deaths, and the starvation, the disease that happened during those during that decade, resulted in millions and millions of deaths. And some scholars put it at 13 million, which was about 8% of the world's population at that time. It was a huge crisis. And then even though the Tang authorities managed to establish themselves again as the central authority, the last half of that whole century was basically a slow and sometimes a rapid decline. It took hundreds of years for China to recover. And if that wasn't enough for the Buddhist establishment, all this going on, around the 800s, so close to the end of the Tang Dynasty, there was an anti-Buddhist persecution movement started by one of the Tang emperors at the time. He realized there were a number of very wealthy Buddhist temples that had accumulated a lot of wealth. There were thousands of monks and nuns that were ordained and not paying taxes. And so he essentially closed many of the temples, forcing the monks and nuns to return to lay life. And the reasons for this was to get the wealth of the temples to use to pay for the army, but also to cleanse China of Buddhism, which the emperor and some of the aristocrats at that time saw as a foreign influence. So Chan, or the Zen tradition, survived all that when many of the other Buddhist schools and establishments disappeared. And this is in part because Zen practitioners would often practice in isolated temples deep in the mountains, away from the large population centers, which of course were targeted easily by the emperor. But Zen practitioners and the Zen tradition also cultivated a flexible attitude to be able to respond to the unknown and a commitment to engage with life as it came to them. And although the Zen monks and nuns did spend time in isolated places like mountains and wild areas, the Zen tradition never encouraged escape from the chaos of the world, but focused on how to be open with some equanimity in those catastrophic times, and then be able to return to the world with gift-bestowing hands. These stories about this, how to do this, the monks and masters that kind of encouraged this, there's many stories and writings, but particularly in the early koans, those short dialogues and statements and stories that are so important in the Zen literature, they embody this practice. And those early koans come exactly out of this time of deep chaos in China. And even the later ones, when things had calmed down, of course, were deeply influenced by the events that happened during that period of time. So all of that is kind of introduction to say today I'd like to talk about a koan from one of the great collections that basically arose out of the Tang Dynasty. I'm going to talk from one from the Book of Serenity. And this is case 12. And it's a relatively short dialogue between Dijang, the teacher, and his student, Shusan. So Dijang himself, this is the main teacher in this dialogue, lived towards the end of the 800s. And he's called Dijang, which is the Chinese pronunciation of Jizo, the archetypal bodhisattva, very popular in Japan for children, travelers, and women. Often seen, he looks like a little monk, bald head, often very cute. But the temple that Dijang was teaching at was called Jizo Temple or Dijang Temple, so that's how he got his name. But some people speculate he also got that name because he was a very kind teacher. He wasn't one of those ones that, you know, whacked people, and he rather pushed people verbally to really deeply consider where they are. So let's consider this koan. I'll read the introduction, and then I'll read the dialogue, or what's called the case. So the introduction is not written by Dijang. It's written by the person who kind of compiled all these koans together in the Book of Serenity. So the introduction goes like this. Scholars plow with the pen. Orators plow with the tongue. We patch-robed monks lazily watch a white ox on open ground, not paying attention to the rootless, auspicious grass. How to pass the days? I'll come back and talk about that in a moment. Let me go ahead and read the dialogue, though. Dijang asked Shusan, "Where do you come from?" Shusan said, "From the south." Dijang said, "How is Buddhism in the south these days?" Shusan said, "There is extensive discussion." Dijang said, "How can that compare to me, here planting the fields and making rice to eat?" Shusan replied, "What can you do about the world?" And Dijang said, "What do you call the world?" Let's go back to the introduction, and then we'll kind of look at some of the rest of the dialogue. Scholars plow with the pen, orators plow with the tongue, we patched-robed monks lazily watch a white ox on open ground, not paying attention to the rootless, auspicious grass. Now, as we all know, of course, a plow is the instrument used to turn up the earth, usually to make it ready for planting. And it's a tool, right, used by the farmers, just as the pen is a tool used by scholars or the tongue by orators. But the patched-robed monks don't have a tool to accomplish anything. They, as it says in the introduction here, lazily watch a white ox on open ground. Now, the compiler of this Book of Serenity here, the man who wrote all the introductions, uses this image, white ox, lazily watch a white ox on open ground, to point us towards Zazen practice, the watching of the mind. In other words, not paying attention to the many thoughts or feelings that arise. That's what the patch-robe monk does. That's what we do when we sit in our meditation. we don't engage with the thoughts and feelings that arise. And then, right after that, the introduction says, how to pass the days. And while this is connected, of course, to the case or the dialogue that we'll discuss in just a moment here, this question arises before us every day, before our feet even touch the floor, right? How shall I pass this day? And during these times, you know, our society and culture offer so many seductive ways to pass the day, right? And often we don't even consider the question. We just plunge in, commandeered perhaps by the to-do list, right? Oh, got to get the oil changed, got to, you know, get the kids off to school, got to make sure I've got the grocery list with me when I leave for work. We get kind of pushed and pulled by one need or one desire after another, often caught just in the whirlwind of circumstances. How shall I pass this day? Well, our foundational practice that we do, of course, is Zazen. When we don't engage in our many thoughts and feelings that arise, I still think it is incumbent upon us to contemplate. To consider, perhaps over a cup of tea or a coffee in the morning, how we are spending our time and our life. Not just plunging into the newspaper or the radio and then off to do whatever we need to do, but taking that moment to recognize the preciousness of life, and maybe taking that moment to recognize the surety of death. And that we don't know, of course, when death will happen. We don't know the place, time, or manner. So a cup of tea. How shall I pass this day? What is most important? So let's talk a little bit about the dialogue, then the case. I'll repeat the first part of it. Dijong asked Shusan, where do you come from? And Shusan said, from the south. Dijong said, how is Buddhism in the south these days? Shusan replied, there is extensive discussion. Now, in the Book of Serenity, there's commentary that follows this case. And apparently, Shusan has returned to Dijong's temple after flubbing his first encounter with Dijong. There's a cute little story about that, but we don't need to go into there. Perhaps Shusan had gone on pilgrimage to the south to visit the many great temples there, and then decided he really needed to return to Dijong's temple, which is a little bit in the north of China, in order to perhaps encounter Dijong again, because he realized he had kind of made a boo-boo there. And perhaps it's just to deepen his practice, because he did become Dijong's student. So if you notice, you know, like most of the koans, this one is a model of kind of call and response. Call and response. A meeting, or sometimes a missing, of two people in the dialogue. How do these two people actually meet each other? A question is asked, a response is made. We must answer, we must respond. The world calls upon us. Our friend calls upon us. Our lover, our spouse calls upon us, and we must respond. Because this is what it means to enter into relationship. And of course, sometimes we do flub it, right? Sometimes we are oblivious, we're dismissive, we're frightened, and the chance to really fully enter an encounter with somebody is lost. And when that is lost, when something is lost in the encounter, when the encounter itself is lost, perhaps, a piece of life is also lost because we don't fully meet that moment right there, right then. Where do you come from? Now, this is a common question in the koan literature. And it's almost always asking for more than like just a place or a name, like I'm from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, or I'm from Stoner, BC. Where do you come from is like saying, show me your true self. Bring forth your Buddha nature. Make it present right here, right now. That's kind of what the question is really for. And of course, Shusan knew that. But perhaps Shusan, being tired from his journey, perhaps missing his cue, he just gives a straight answer, a mundane answer. He says, from the south. I'm from the southern part of China. I've just come back. And then Dijong gives Shusan another chance. He says, well, so you're from the south, eh? How's Buddhism in the south these days? And Shusan replies, there is extensive discussion. Now, I don't really know, but perhaps in the south of China at this time, there were great gatherings where teachers would give long lectures, illuminating different difficult sutras or engaging in debates over fine points of Dharma. Or maybe just the monks and nuns were kind of coming together a lot to talk about the teachings. Buddhism did become quite popular during the second half of the Tang Dynasty when this dialogue is taking place. Nevertheless, hearing Shusan's answer, the first response by a good Zen student, perhaps, would be to point out how extensive discussion flies in the face of Bodhidharma's great dictum. Remember Bodhidharma being that semi-mythical Indian monk who first brought the Zen practice and teachings to China. And it goes like this, of course. A special transmission outside the scriptures, not depending on words or letters, pointing directly to the mind, seeing into one's true nature and attaining Buddhahood. In other words, unlike some of the other schools that were popular in China at that time, Zen practice is not about describing the Buddha's cosmos or the world or human psychology, although there is a lot of literature about that. Zen practice is bringing forth our whole life, actualizing the fundamental point, as Dogen wrote. Now, I have little doubt that Shusan knew this, right? Beyond words and letters. And he knew skillful use of words can also, though, be a Dharma gate. Because after all, Dijong, the great teacher, has started this very discussion, right? What's going on in the south of Buddhism these days? So perhaps Shusan was kind of hoping for an awakening word or some response that would deepen his own insight from Dijong. So Dijong's reply to that, there is extensive discussion, is this. How can that compare to me here planting fields and making rice to eat? In other words, how can extensive discussion compare to the practical work that I'm doing right here? So maybe perhaps there's an implied criticism there, right? What use is discussion when planting fields will feed people? And our Zen tradition, as most of you know, deeply values work. Work can take us out of our heads, back into our bodies. And as Dogen wrote in the instructions to the cook, the Tenzo Kyokan, one of the most important positions in the whole monastery is the Tenzo, the head cook. And the great teacher, Chinese teacher Baijiang, who actually lived through that terrible An Lushan rebellion, and also through part of the Buddhist persecution, he was really resolute on working every day. When he became old and enfeebled, the monks around him felt sorry. And so they hid Baijiang's tools. And Baijiang, when he couldn't find his tools, stopped eating. And he said, "I have no virtue. Why should others work for me? A day without work is a day without eating." And that's, of course, one of the most famous Zen sayings. And to this day, all the Zen schools highlight the importance of work within practice. But at this point in the dialogue, Shusan exclaims to Dijang, "What can you do about the world?" In other words, fine, nice answer, Master Dijang. But here you are tending your lovely field here in the mountains, growing rice for yourself and your fellow monks, very far away from all the travails of the world. This world is full of sorrow and trouble. People haven't yet recovered from the great Anyan Rebellion, and our Buddhist tradition is still weak from the persecution that happened. Can't you feel the pain of the world? Do you not grieve over it? And maybe Shusan is asking us the same question. What can you do about those suffering from COVID-19? About those experiencing brutality of all kinds? About the inequality that we see everywhere? About the confusion and the stress of these times? The details vary by place and time, but the question remains for each of us. What can you do about the world? You know, given the weight and the suffering in the world, we may feel hopeless and give up. Or we may throw ourselves into one challenge after another until we burn out or kind of fall into despair. Yet our bodhisattva vows don't allow us to turn away. Caring and helping are absolutely essential. They are, after all, expressions of our Buddha nature. What can you do about the world? A request is made. How will you respond? I think this is one of our life koans. One of those koans that arise within our life at some point, and the only way to resolve it is to live the koan. We resolve it through the very living of our life. What can you do about the world? Now, I'm sure the great teacher, Dijang, understood this completely. And his answer is both powerful and a bit mysterious. What do you call the world? That's his answer. What do you call the world? And I've been pondering this answer of his for a while, because I find it just stops me in my tracks. What do I call the world? Is the world out there, separate in some way from me? I know I habitually kind of assume that. But when I made the pause as this question, what do I call the world? What do you call the world? Makes me pause. That assumption of separateness no longer makes so much sense to me. I and the world are not two things. it is perhaps like a difference of perspective. I was thinking of this, you know, it's like a child at a beach building a sandcastle that we assume is kind of ourself. And we assemble our life, we put our life together, like the child puts a sandcastle together. And then when the tide comes in and begins to erode our carefully constructed self, we cry. How could the world do this to me? On the other hand, the parents of the child, you know, enjoying the day, maybe seeing the sandcastle gradually being washed away. No, it's just part of nature. It's just the impermanence of all things. It's not something done to their child. They don't get upset. The habitual view that we carry is that ourself somehow is separate and in control. At least, we hope, it's not largely in control. And that leads us to kind of construct notions of I, me, and mine. So the world becomes kind of a vast collection of objects that are outside. But when we investigate closely, we understand we are the world. The world is us. In almost every way. I was just reading the other day about, I can't remember where the article was, but apparently, if you were to look at your body today, the kind of, at the atomic level of your body today versus 7 years ago, you'd find that over 99.9% of your atoms have been replaced by other atoms. Almost all of them, of course, from outside. But there's another way, another more intimate way that we can know that we are not separate from the world. When the mind and heart are at ease, when they're at ease, the world fetches us to itself. As Dogen wrote in the Genjo Koan, to study the Buddha ways, to study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. And when actualized by the myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. Practicing over time, I think we notice that the more that I clarify myself, the more that I clarify who I am, the more the world is made clear. That the eggshell-like kind of boundary that we kind of assume between me and the world is there, it cracks, or maybe it becomes a little more porous. And it's no longer quite so evident where I begin, or rather where I end and the world begins. What do you call the world? And maybe another question connected to that is, how does the world call you? Shusan, the disciple, asks us, what can you do about the world? Perhaps the first thing we practice is to dispel our illusion about being independent from this world. And we commit to offer the care and engagement with whatever is needed to be done without an idea of me helping. Me doing good works. And we acknowledge, though, again and again, our vow to take responsibility for our actions, to take responsibility for the world. I'd like to end with a quote by that great Czech writer, dramatist, and also the former president of the Czech Republic. Václav Havel. He wrote this: "Today's world, as we know, is faced with multiple threats. From whichever angle I look at this menace, I always come to the conclusion that salvation can only come through a profound awakening of each person to his and her own personal responsibility, which is at the same time a global responsibility." So, two koans for us to hold close over this next while. What can you do about the world? What do you call the world? Perhaps these koans lack the pizzazz of, like, you know, show me the face before your parents were born, or the sound of one hand clapping. But they are really precious tools of our practice. Just like the plow, the pen, the tongue, these may be the koans, these questions are our tools. They are fingers pointing us towards the moon of wisdom and compassion. And I think if we can take them to heart, they will give us each pause in the hurly-burliness of our daily life, and maybe offer us the chance to open up to the vast landscape of who we truly are. Well, thank you for listening. I greatly appreciate it in this beautiful summer day. Maybe it's time for people to head out, enjoy a little bit of sun. But before we do, we're going to have service. And I'm hoping Susan can be Doshi. And I'll try ring the bells as best I can following Susan's movements. And there'll be, of course, the things posted, the chance to post it. So anyway, we'll give this a whirl, and hopefully it will all go smoothly. So we'll just end with the closing chant, and then we'll go right into service. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.